So how has this one Wisconsin county managed to already fully vaccinate more than a quarter of those qualified for the COVID vaccine? It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. Public health stories like these can't help but make you feel a little bit better after this past year. And our northernmost county leads the state in vaccination rates, and our guest this morning is Bayfield County's public health director. So if you're anywhere in Bayfield County this morning, join us and let us know how the vaccination experience has been for you. Or if you just like to share your story of how you found or have yet to find the vaccine, the number to the studio is 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us ideas@wpr.org. Our guest, Sarah Wortman, public health director for Bayfield County. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And give us an idea of how this success story came to be in Bayfield County. I know initially there were concerns about vaccination rollouts in rural parts of our state. So what's led to Bayfield County's success, Sarah?
I feel like there's a few different factors that have contributed to our success. I think one of them is that we have a standing history of preparing for and carrying out mass vaccination plans in our county, that we've routinely done mass vaccine clinics every year with the schools for practice just for this very same thing. And so that's been a huge factor to make sure that we've worked out any issues or any slowdowns or bottlenecks with vaccine clinics even before the pandemic. Staff are trained and used to doing this and used to going and taking the show on the road. So I think that is a huge factor. We also partner extremely closely with many of these agencies that are delivering vaccine. When we knew that Walgreens and box store pharmacies like CVS Walgreens weren't going to come in and help us necessarily with the vaccine rollout, we started planning pretty early on, knowing that public health was going to be taking a leadership role.
Sarah, when you say early on, how far back are we talking here?
Well, we started talking with the state about vaccine rollout in June, and they encouraged us to start looking June through the fall about our vaccine plans. And then I'd say we really took an in-depth look in November at our existing plans and where we could use sites, how we would deliver this, knowing that the vaccine would come out in January. Originally, we had done our flu clinics in the fall as a drive-through clinic, all via vehicles, via cars. And we knew in January at minus 30 that wasn't going to be an option anymore. So we had to pivot and change a couple times. I try to always include our public health department in the planning because they'll point out something like, yeah, everybody will freeze. That's not going to work. fingers will freeze off. and so we had discussions early on about where in the county, where are these deserts for healthcare in our county. And we started to apply for all of those sites to be a vaccine, a site where we could distribute. Ultimately, what we found out after the first couple of weeks with clinic is taking down and setting up all of the time was actually kind of a misuse of time. And so we started to develop a standing clinic at a school that was no longer open, that had closed their door about a decade ago. And we just made a standing clinic and then continued to do clinics from there.
Is that standing clinic still open and operating, Sarah?
Correct.
And how many days a week is it working?
Anywhere from usually 2 to 3 days a week. It's usually Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, depending on the vaccine allotment that week.
So Bayfield County's has a history of mass vaccinations, and you partnered with other agencies. But as I understand it, Sarah Wortman, you also partnered with neighboring counties like Iron and Ashland counties.
Correct. Every single week throughout the pandemic, and actually more often early on in the pandemic in 2020, we've met with a group called the Cooperators Group, and that's between Ashland County, Bayfield County, Iron County, Red Cliff Tribe, and Bad River Tribe.
And what were those meetings like? What came out of that collaboration?
We tried to address some of the confusion in messaging and have more consistent messages that were not conflicting among agencies. We developed news releases and educational messages for the public through, especially using Memorial Medical Center, one of the area hospitals that serves this region, was a part of the group as well, and we were able to use their public relations department to develop some really nice messaging. It was good because it kind of created some solidarity, shared information. And we could plan at a more regional level.
Sarah Wortman, our guest, she's the public health director in Bayfield County, which is the county that leads the state in vaccination rates to date. Be interested in knowing what your take is on the state's vaccine rollout at 1-800-642-1234. Always email ideas at WPR.org. And to what degree have the Red Cliff and Bad River tribal organizations led to some of the successes we're seeing in the vaccination rollout in northern Wisconsin, Sarah?
Absolutely an incredible amount. For example, Red Cliff is near to what we've completed with Bayfield County Health Department for vaccine administration. They've given approximately 1,500 to 2,000 shots for our community, and that is a huge asset to have. The tribes do not necessarily have to follow the state guidelines for eligibility, and so they were able to open things up a little bit earlier than we were as a health department following the state guidelines for eligibility. And so I cannot state enough, especially with Red Cliff Tribe in our community, they were able to vaccinate quite a few people. And, you know, from their perspective, the tribe had been offered first, and then they expanded it to tribal members anywhere across the community, regardless of if Red Cliff tribal status, and actually then they opened it up to Bayfield County residents and others, partly because they knew that by protecting their greater community, they were protecting their tribal members.
And we've seen the stories of Native communities across the country with incredible vaccination rates, incredible success stories from the Dakotas all the way through our state of Wisconsin. Do you have some insight into what's behind that, Sarah?
I think that they have been one of the strongest leaders in this pandemic in northern Wisconsin, at least from what I've seen and from working with them, especially when I look at their staffing levels and how many people actually are pulling off these mass vaccine clinics. It's only a handful of people who are planning and organizing it, more people actually working the clinic. But I've been so impressed, just stunned at the ability of our tribes to really to play such a leadership role in this vaccine rollout.
Let's go to Bruce in Green Bay. Bruce, good morning. You're on the morning show.
Good morning.
What do you think?
Well, I got my vaccine as a caregiver. I had my first shot. I got it through Walgreens. It was a very easy process. Wasn't able to get a slot the first time I signed up or went to look, but you're just checking daily. I was able to schedule very easily. I was able to and also scheduled the second shot at the same time as the first one automatically. So it was a very easy process. Walgreens in particular, and I'm sure that, other organizations are similar, has just done a great job. I've gotten flu vaccines there. I've gotten tetanus shots there and so on. So, they've just a great way to handle it. And I think we needed, needed some government oversight at a high level. But if we had waited for the government to actually provide the inoculations, which they'd still be talking about it. So I think it's been a really good example of involving the private sector and getting things done.
Did that first jab change your headspace, Bruce? Did that give you a little light at the end of this tunnel?
Certainly I was glad I had the first one out of the way and the second one scheduled. I wasn't concerned about getting the vaccine maybe at first, but I think when you consider the risk of getting COVID versus the risk of the shot, I don't think there's any comparison. You're much better off getting the shot.
Bruce, thank you for the call. And Sarah, I have to imagine you would echo Bruce's sentiments there.
Absolutely. And for us, it's not a competition about who gives the vaccine. It's how can we connect people to a vaccine, a vaccinating provider. And so when someone calls us and says, hey, we got a shot at Walgreens or CVS, we're just happy. We're happy you're connected, happy you were able to get your first dose.
Sarah Wortman with us. She is the public health director for Bayfield County. And I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning. Interested in your vaccine stories at 1-800-642-1234. Do you live in rural Wisconsin? And how do you view vaccine accessibility for you? We'll take your calls and continue with Sarah Wortman. 90 seconds here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is Sarah Wortman, the public health director of Bayfield County, where more than 40% of the population has had at least one shot of the COVID vaccine. And you know, seeing and hearing all these stories of eligible friends and family getting the vaccine feels good on a Friday. So I'm going to encourage you to share your vaccination tales. Or if you've struggled finding the vaccine, we'd want to hear that too this morning at 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest, public health director for Bayfield County, Sarah Wortman. And Sarah, some of the concerns about the vaccine rollout had been access to technology. And when we're talking about northern Wisconsin, we're talking about broadband access almost on a constant basis. It's the governor that started the year by saying this was the year of broadband. But as I understand it, Bayfield County, in some cases, was going door to door and doing a paper trail in order to get around concerns over broadband connectivity in order to connect your residents to the vaccine.
Correct. There are some pockets of our county that have fantastic fiber optic connections, and then there are other pockets of the county that are still very slow, or people who have limited access to computers, smartphones, or other methods to register to an online form. So we actually partnered with Human Services and the Senior Meals on Wheels program to deliver paper forms to everyone who's eligible for the Meals on Wheels program and make sure that they were able to register if they wanted to.
Sarah, about 3,000 people in Bayfield County are 65 years or older, and as the numbers show, more than 70% of them have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. So how long do you expect it to take until these residents will be fully vaccinated now?
As of the end of this week, 82% of those 65 and older are vaccinated, so we're actually nearing completing our 65-plus population. And I think there's about 4,300. It's actually quite a lot of residents 65 and older who qualified, which may be why our immunization rates look, or vaccination rates look so good, because when things opened up for 65-plus, a large portion of our 28% of our population was then eligible.
And as you had mentioned earlier, you along with the state had started planning on a rollout for the vaccine. Was it last June?
We started at least with broad ideas mm-hmm. in June, practiced them for our flu clinics in the fall in October, and then we rehoned the plans when we realized that it's going to be bitterly cold starting in November, December.
And this Meals on Wheels program, I'm sure it serves hundreds of homes. And as you got that paper trail back, I'm also interested in those who, you know, for many folks, their connection to the community is that Meals on Wheels delivery, what their feedback has been like about their opportunity for access.
I think that some have said that it was a challenge if they didn't have internet, but for the most part, our online form, any of the paper forms were entered into the online form for us for practicality purposes. But we found that people had friends, neighbors, relatives, or a church member, and if someone didn't have internet access to do the survey, usually someone reached out and helped assist them signing up. They'd call us and say, is my aunt so-and-so on? I'm really worried. And we'd say, you know, so it's really good word-of-mouth communication up here, very strong internet community.
So, Sarah, what is your focus right now? As the public health director of Bayfield County, you know, you're leading the state in vaccination rates, but I'm sure you're continuing to find or try to find ways to make sure that the vaccine can become available to anybody who is interested in obtaining it. So where are you finding your challenges today?
Some of the confusion we've noticed is with the rollout of pharmacies up here. People aren't always getting the second appointment, and so we're trying to connect people who weren't able to schedule their second dose to make sure that they're able to complete the series. So that's one thing we're working on. We're also trying to have a better response between Red Cliff, Bad River, Ashland, and Bayfield counties so that people aren't getting duplicate phone calls all trying to schedule them for an appointment. It gets confusing for our residents when they're getting multiple calls. We're definitely working through our list, but we've launched a new registration form that is between the four different entities currently, and then we continue to really partner with our, we only have one pharmacy not affiliated with a clinic in Bayfield County, and so we continue to partner very closely with them so we aren't duplicating efforts.
Sarah Wortman's the public health director in Bayfield County, and are you someone that's fully vaccinated now? How's that feel for you? 1-800-642-1234. Are you planning to not get vaccinated? And be interested in you sharing your reasoning behind it this morning. 1-800-642-1234. You know, other public health directors have certainly been in the news this past year, and as a public health crisis, it certainly has to have been challenging. And certainly this morning, there's some good news and some light at the end of the tunnel and some rewarding stories to share this morning. But Sarah, as a public health director of Bayfield County, what's this last year been like for you?
Like nothing else. Like nothing else I've ever experienced. I do enjoy public health, but at the best of times we had people praising us and thanking us, and at the worst of time I've had people screaming and upset, and that's been really demoralizing at times. However, I try to think about all of the positive feedback from the community and just know that we're doing the best we can with our resources.
You haven't had any epidemiologists yell at you, have you?
No. There are no epidemiologists on our staff. And no, I have not had any.
I start thinking about what other counties could do. And when we started the conversation, Sarah, you said, you know, Bayfield County has a history of mass vaccinations, and that's part of our success story this morning. So it's not like we can go back and recreate the history, but what advice would you give to other counties across the state, across the country, about ramping up vaccination rates?
For us, our staff were adamant that even if it seemed like our next allotment was too much to handle over our capacity, our staff were adamant that they could do it. They were determined, had tenacity. And I'd say, don't refuse vaccine. If you can handle it, if you can have additional volunteers, retired nurses or doctors to help you with your clinics, don't turn away vaccine. Just keep on doing your clinics at the capacity you can do, and eventually, kind of like slow and steady wins the race, eventually that will make a difference.
And that's the same way we're combating this epidemic on a global scale. Slow and steady will win the race. But there is some, to some degree, Sarah, there is some race against mutations and changes to the COVID. And so how do you, as a public health director, plan, or can you plan for something like that?
That's partly why I credit our staff to have the tenacity and the determination to meet these goals. Every time we get another allotment, I ask if we can do it, and they say for every shot we give, it's one less case in a couple weeks. It's one less death. It's one more person protected, and the sooner we can vaccinate people, the better protected we are against variants. And I completely agree. We're racing time against these variants.
Is that what keeps you going in the face of some who may scream against public health and epidemiology?
Absolutely. We've had people, after getting their shot, sitting in their seat crying out of joy.
Yes.
Crying out of joy that their life is saved. And for some with autoimmune issues, yep, and multiple medical, it's truly a race against time with these variants.
So, Sarah, with the rate of vaccines, is Bayfield County ready to reduce mask wearing and social distancing measures to contain this virus?
Absolutely not. No, actually, even though 43% of our population, nearly 43% of our population has had at least one shot of COVID vaccine, and 82% of our 65 and older are vaccinated, we're still seeing outbreaks among younger groups, among children and young adults who haven't been fully vaccinated. And so, no, in fact, we went from low risk 2 weeks ago to medium to high this week for disease activity. So, no, we are not out of it. I plan on wearing a mask all of 2021. We're not out of this, especially with states like Nevada, Arizona, and California with over 50% variants. We're not out of it.
Sarah Wortman, thank you so much for your work and joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and stay healthy and well.
Sarah Wortman's the Public Health Director for Bayfield County. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. We're going to be talking to a Washington Post journalist about President Biden's administration's move so far when it comes to the environment and how they're unrolling the previous administration's environmental legacy. Keeping track of that at the Washington Post website, and we'll have the details for you after this morning's Wisconsin Life. A special story from our own Andrea Anderson this morning. Here's producer Maureen McCollum about parenthood during the pandemic.
Bringing a new life into this world is a blessing, and being able to share a newborn with family and friends is one of the biggest joys parents can have. But the coronavirus pandemic has taken these moments away from many families, leaving them with a slew of emotions to work through. WPR's Andrea Anderson shares these feelings in a letter to her newborn, Magnolia.
Dearest Magnolia, I write part of the story on my phone as we snuggle in the rocking chair and you drift to sleep. One of the dogs quietly peeks his head through the baby gate and then walks away. The cat purrs nearby, wishing she could be sitting on the chair's armrest. As I feel your warmth and hear your teeny soft snores, I think about the world you were born into in June. It's a world where millions have died from a new virus that has torn the global economy apart and turned life upside down. It's a world where your sister's is normal is but a memory and also a goal, as they yearn for hangouts with friends, birthday parties, and seeing your cousins. But the world isn't all bad at this time. People have come together like never before in some ways, working to help those in need. Sweet Magnolia, you were born into a house and family full of love in one of the darkest times this world has seen. And while many people, including me, struggle to see the light, you are that light our family needs. We made plans with your grandparents to come and visit right after you were born. But March came and our plans looked like a distant dream in the midst of a pandemic. We'd say optimistically at the end of Zoom calls and FaceTimes, maybe June will be different. But June came and the world was no better. Except for you. You were born into so much love, but only four people could share you. Your two sisters, your father, and me. Your grandparents waited at their faraway homes for text messages with pictures and videos. They waited for video calls. After a two-week quarantine, just a couple weeks after you were born, they finally got to hold you because we posed no risk. Imagine a newborn, only a few weeks old, could pose a lethal risk to her own grandparents. It was unimaginable, yet our reality. Your little, beautiful self filled their hearts with joy. It was as if I could see their bodies recharging every second they held you. They didn't want to let you go because they didn't know when they'd get to see you again. It made me cry. The visits came to an end, and we hoped we'd see them soon. But the pandemic continued. The milestones you reach, sweet Magnolia, have been celebrated. But for each one you make, a part of me breaks inside, because your village can't see her first in person. You bring so much laughter and joy. Your giggles are the best when your sisters make funny faces and rub their nose to yours, or when they tickle your belly. Your chattering in the morning is the best alarm clock. Your wobbly wave is the cutest. The four of us get to experience your deep sighs and your snuggles, your infectious smile. We get to see you roll over, then crawl, then stand. We hear you say, hey, and dada. See, Magnolia, this pandemic has robbed so many people of so many things. It's not fair. No one ever asked for this to be how it is, but no matter what, we have you and all the future memories to share with your village. This will all come to an end someday, but for now, sweet Magnolia, you remain our hope and our light.
WPR's Andrea Anderson shares a letter that she wrote to her newborn, Magnolia. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Thank you to Andrea and to Maureen. Now, confronting climate change and committing to environmental justice. That has been the pledge of Joe Biden's administration, and the Washington Post has been keeping track. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and our next guest is a part of the Washington Post team following the Biden administration's environmental policies and what they're doing to the legacy of President Trump. You have the opportunity this morning to share your priorities for the environment and make them heard statewide at 1-800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Juliette Alperin is a senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. Juliette, good morning.
Good morning, Lee.
So give us some scope of your project that your team's working on at The Washington Post and why you and your colleagues saw a need to track these policies in this way.
Well, as you can imagine, for example, over the entire course of Donald Trump's term, my colleague, particularly Brady Dennis, and I had been, you know, tracking all of these environmental and energy policy rollbacks that the administration had been pursuing as it sought to deregulate what the federal government does and you know, on policies that affect people's lives across the country. And we wanted to take stock of it some way. And we partnered with John Myskins, a really talented graphic reporter, because we wanted to tell the story in an interactive and visual way. And so what we did is we started compiling every single policy we could identify that the Trump administration had pursued that affected existing environmental protections. And so we started this before the election and then wanted to pursue it either way, regardless of whether President Trump won re-election or lost. And now it's become a really helpful tool in tracking both what President Biden has been doing to reverse his predecessor's policies on climate change and other issues, but also track what he's doing because he's obviously moving ahead on different policies that are new that we think Americans would want to know about.
So, Juliette, what are the numbers so far this morning on the Washington Post tracker?
Well, we need to publish another update. But right now, what we have is that out of roughly 200 policies that the Trump administration pursued, 22 have been overturned. Another 70 are targeted by President Biden, and 19 new environmental protections have been added. It's worth noting, in fact, I was reporting with a couple of my colleagues just in the past couple of days, that there have been a couple changes, including at least one more policy has been overturned by the Environmental Protection Agency. So we're at nearly two dozen policies overturned.
So nearly two dozen previous administration policies overturned, 70 still targeted for the future, and 19 new policies for the environment put in place already by the Biden administration. Juliette Eilprint, how much of this can be done with the stroke of a presidential pen? How are these how are the rollbacks of the previous administration being restored by the current administration?
That's a great question. So the vast majority of these policies were adopted by the executive branch, which allows them to be reversed by the executive branch. That's not every single one, but the vast majority of them. So what that means is that they can be reversed by President Biden, but some can be done by a stroke of a pen. We saw that when on his first day of office, he, for example, rejected an international permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would transmit heavy crude from Canada down to the Gulf Coast. He also rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement. Those are the easy things to do. Then there are others that take a little more time and involve, for example, rescinding an existing rule, proposing a new one. So some can take longer, but and then there are a very small number where you actually would need congressional action, which are quite difficult, especially if they were struck down by the previous Congress, which is what happened in the early days of the Trump administration.
Juliet Alperin is our guest, senior national affairs correspondent with the Washington Post, with a graphic, interactive, and visual tally of the Biden administration's environmental policies and how they compare to the previous administration. And Juliet, as you had mentioned, the President Biden is implementing additional policies, 19 by your tally to date. What are some of those examples?
So some of the new policies that he's undertaking are things, you know, certainly that have to do with climate change. That's certainly one of his, you know, big, you know, a focus of his. So they include everything from, for example, signing an executive order that calls for an analysis of the national security implications of climate change and what it means for, you know, refugee migration. It's also things like a pause on all new leasing on federal lands and waters, and issues like he's trying to expand offshore wind power. So we saw the Interior Department sign off on a critical environmental approval for a massive wind farm off Massachusetts Martha's Vineyard. So it's a mix of things, but certainly in terms of some of the initial affirmative policies that the Biden administration is doing, a number of them have to do with either climate or this issue, as you mentioned, of environmental justice. How do you address the disproportionate pollution burden that disadvantaged communities and communities of color face in the United States?
So, Juliet, is it fair then that what we're seeing to some degree is what we're watching for right now are new policies, the overturning of previous policies and targeted policies that are moving to the future. But when we look towards, and you mentioned greenhouse gases and climate change, what about pollution? As your colleagues track 64 Trump administration policies that aim to weaken or overturn regulations on air pollution, how's the Biden administration attempting to now curb that pollution?
Well, a great example just happened, in fact, yesterday, which is the Environmental Protection Agency withdrew a critical air pollution permit for an oil refinery in the Virgin Islands on St. Croix. This is something that I wrote about with a couple of my colleagues. And what's interesting about this is an oil refinery which, to a great extent, is really supported by politicians on the Virgin Islands. It used to be a huge source of revenue. It had tremendous environmental violations and ran into trouble and shut down nearly a decade ago. The Trump administration took a fairly novel interpretation of the Clean Air Act and paved the way for it to reopen. It restarted on February 1st. And then within 3 days, there was an accident that actually showered fine mist of oil over hundreds of homes in a neighboring impoverished community. And so the EPA is taking a look at this and specifically cited issues like, you know, traditional air pollution and environmental justice in reassessing that decision. So we are seeing it, but many of those policies, again, would take an extended rulemaking process to change. This was kind of unusual in that it could be done more quickly than others.
3 days after reopening and it has its first environmental disaster or accident?
Yeah, it was pretty shocking. It was unexpected. It was actually, it triggered a safety valve. It actually protected people at the at the plant itself. So it could have been, in fact, even a deadly accident if things had gone wrong. But it did again. It had this impact that really kind of brought back all the memories of what was problematic about this plant. But at the same point, you know, again, obviously we are still using fossil fuels. Oil refineries are important. And so this is the political tightrope that the administration walks when it tries to navigate these questions.
Juliette Eilprin is on the team working to track the Biden administration's environmental policies, including their effort to address some of the 170 Trump-era environmental rollbacks. Do we lose too much ground on climate change under President Trump? Do we risk losing too much ground in the economy under President Biden? 1-800-642-1234. How do you see that nexus of the environment and the economy today? We'll take your questions and continue with our guest from The Washington Post in 2 minutes. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Drilling, mining, logging, it all matters to Wisconsin, and the decisions made in Washington, D.C. are bound to affect our air, water, and soil, energy, and the economy. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is a senior national affairs correspondent at The Washington Post, where you will find their running interactive tally of President Biden's environmental policies and how they're undoing President Trump's work. So how do you feel about the back and forth over our environmental protections? And how do you view the economics of the environment and the actions that our presidents unilaterally can take? Phone number is 1-800-642-1234. Email available to you at ideas@wpr.org. Juliette Eilprin is on the team working to track the Biden administration's environmental policies, including their effort to address some of the 170 Trump-era environmental rollbacks. And Juliette, I can't help but think how many of those Trump-era environmental rollbacks were in response to the Obama administration's environmental protections. How much of this is the ping-pong and back and forth of environmental policy dependent on who's in office?
You raise a great point. Certainly a significant number of the rollbacks that we're talking about were actually policies enacted under Barack Obama. I mean, and this is one of the conundrums that we face when it comes to national energy and environmental policy, which is that, frankly, there's been Congress has been so paralyzed when it comes to making these decisions that it's effectively ceded all of the action to whoever's in the Oval Office. And so you do have this big back and forth where, depending on who voters decide to elect as president, you see a radical shift, a kind of a pendulum shift in terms of policy. And one of the interesting things that we're certainly watching, you know, this year and in the coming few years is whether there's enough of a consensus that can build on some of these issues that the warring sides can come together and reach some sort of more enduring compromise that stays in place regardless of, for example, who's in office come 4 years from now.
And I have to wonder about the net effect, not just on the environment, but also on the economy when policies like these that have drastic effects across the land and water and soil and air can go back and forth every 8, 12, even 4 years. What's the net effect?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you see a few different things. First of all, it makes it very difficult for companies to make decisions, you know, and to advance projects because it's hard to know, you know, what kind of approval they're going to get. A great example is, for example, in Minnesota, where we've recently seen action. You know, some of your listeners might have visited Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness or be aware of it. You know, here's this wilderness area that in the waning days of the Obama administration, the federal government denied the renewal of a couple of mining leases nearby, noting that it could affect the environment. Then within a matter of months after President Trump took office, the Interior Department issued a legal opinion reversing course and saying that, you know, these leases could be renewed. So basically the company started gearing up to start mining. There's been lawsuits over it. And sure enough, this month, a federal judge granted the Biden administration's request to pause the litigation as it, you know, essentially reassesses the legality of this. So, you know, I mean, there are some cases, as you mentioned, where, you know, you do have when there's uncertainty and business moves forward and you do have air pollution emitted or water pollution. There are other times where simply you know, different projects get stuck in limbo because it's unclear whether it can go forward.
So the politics of this are obvious when it comes to environmental policy and whoever's in the White House. Juliet Eilprin is the senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post, and she's been covering the Biden administration's environmental policy moves. And, so we see on the face of it the politics involved in environmental policy. But behind that, how has science been involved in our environmental policy from administration to administration, Juliet?
Well, again, we've certainly seen a difference of opinion at times. Scientists often raise uncomfortable truths and findings about the implications of policies. There's no question that, for example, under the Trump administration, there are multiple times when political appointees ignored scientific recommendations as they adopted policies. Although it's worth saying that there are certainly times that did happen under the Obama administration. We're waiting to see what happens under Biden. He has, signed an executive order that prioritizes the role of science in decision making, and we'll see how that ends up informing policies going forward.
So we're going to keep an eye on your graphic and interactive visual counter tracker of the Biden administration's environmental policies. But what is your team at the Washington Post keeping an eye on, Juliet Eilprin?
Well, I think we're really looking at a number of things, including the fact that the president has pledged to mobilize the entire government to address climate change and environmental challenges. So, for example, what is the Agriculture Department going to do about it in the months and few years ahead? That's going to have huge implications for whether it's Wisconsin or other states. What's happening at the Transportation Department? So I think or even in the Treasury Department. So we'll be looking for kind of some of the unexpected policies that will affect people's lives and the planet.
But the politics will certainly play a role in this. To what degree would Congress have to play a role in any sort of consistency in environmental policy? How much of this will be dependent on some sort of bipartisanship?
For really enduring policies, you often need a bipartisan consensus. And so, for example, as the president gets up to start pushing for his infrastructure bill, it's going to be critical to see what are the proposals that ultimately would help speed the transition to, say, a clean energy future that Republicans as well as Democrats can support. And you're right. In many cases, you can have short-term victories, but if you really want those long-term meaningful policies, it really will depend on what Congress is willing to approve.
Juliet Eilprin, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
I enjoyed it.
Juliet Eilprin is a senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. Keep an eye on their running tracker at thewashingtonpost.com's website. And join us next Friday for the start of a four-week movie club on The Morning Show. Have you seen Mank yet? The Trial of the Chicago 7? Well, every Friday in April leading up to the Academy Awards, we'll be discussing two of the Best Picture nominees. And first up, a couple of period pieces, Mank and The Trial of the Chicago 7. Check them out over the next week and let's talk about them next Friday. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.